talked about that. I think it's all those guys. You know, we're waiting for the James Webb telescope. That's ours, as well as theirs. See, that's going to be launched from the same location. That's going to be launched on a on an Ariane 5 rocket from French Guiana, South America. Just like this one did. This one was launched from the same location, but without any help from NASA. The only difference is it was launched on a Soyuz rocket. And don't think Russians. I mean, the Russians didn't go down. It's another, you know, Cuban missile crisis bringing Russian rockets there. But the European Space Agency is buying up some of the Soyuz rockets and bringing them to South America. This was the sixth launch of the Soyuz spacecraft from that launch facility. Back to you.
And I think you may have said it, but I may have missed it, Paul. What's your best guess as to when Gaia will be on station at Lagrange Point number 2 and begin operation? What's your best guess as to when it might start operation? How back to you, Paul.
Well, as of yesterday, they were getting things ready. I mean, you know, checking the cameras, make sure the communications is going good. And, I don't know, some of these things that are put up there, to calibrate things takes sometimes a month or two, but I haven't heard when it's going to be officially in operation. But when it is, it's a six-year project, so. And they've got about 6 years before it moves into what you would call a total eclipse situation. It stays not... it doesn't go into the penumbra of the light. You don't want to do that. It's going to wreak havoc on the spacecraft itself. They've got about 6 years before that happens. And then if they have enough fuel, they're going to move it out of the way for a while. They don't want it in this, what they call the eclipse location. And then they'll probably push it back. And, you know, they've got an extended mission out of it, knowing these guys. It's no different than that.
Now, Gaia is located where? Is it traversing the distance now from Earth toward Lagrange Point number 2? Or has it essentially arrived at Lagrange Point number 2 and is being checked out? Roughly where is it in the big plan of operation, Paul? Go ahead.
I knew that didn't get through on the other repeater. That's how I started off. It is there. It has arrived. After that, I was telling you that because it has arrived, they're fooling with electronics and getting everything ready and making sure it's working. So, yeah, it's there. It's 1 million miles out and Lagrange Point 2. Anybody that's listening, Lagrange Point, I know we've talked about it a million times, Dick, but one is between Sun and Earth. Two is if you go Sun, Earth, and then beyond the Earth. 1 million miles out, four times faster than the distance of the moon. And three would be opposite side of the sun. Then you have a four and five. They're located in front of the direction of travel from the Earth. And also one behind. So this is Lagrange Point 2. Back to you.
Roughly how long ago did it arrive at Lagrange Point number 2, Paul? And I get the impression they're checking out the camera right now, and so camera is probably plural, and so I guess you're saying they're about to go into operation. So how long ago did it arrive at Lagrange Point number 2, to your knowledge, Paul? Go ahead.
I read that yesterday, and I think it was, they always put happened 12 hours ago or something like this, so probably a day and a half, I guess, 2 days.
Okay, since the last check then, it has arrived on station and is being checked out, and no one has made a prediction as to when the camera checkout will be completed and real measurement operation begins. Back to you, Paul.
I haven't found it, no. I was just happy to see it got there, and they gave it a 100 health check. Everything, whatever is on board, working. I was glad to hear that. that they're going to push the bus pretty soon and make sure this thing is calibrated properly and put it into operation. And then the results coming back is going to be tremendous. You get how many terabytes of information.
The other ones, the Blue Origin
while there. You're only going to go up to 2020. You wouldn't need all these other contractors. Bob, now they're all going to step up the pace a little bit better. It's going to be a big improvement with the that extension. By the way, that's Eric that's working on those repeaters. I wish I had that technical ability. I'd fall back easily.
If you got the time and you know when Eric is going out there to these various sites, there's a chance you could tag along with him and learn if you wanted to. I think it's possible, Paul. Now, the question I've got is that, it's a great big question. Oh, yes. Right now, when it comes to cosmonauts, astronauts, going from Earth to International Space Station and International Space Station back to ground, to my knowledge, the only vehicle that transports them is Soyuz. Give me a guess, Paul, how soon will it be when one of these alternate vehicles, other than Soyuz, will be transporting astronauts up or down? WS2N, T2RIW?
I bet on SpaceX 2017, but Boeing's doing pretty good. Yeah, right. CST-100, so they're coming along. Dream Chaser by Sierra Nevada, coming along, but I think they're going to have to really work hard to catch SpaceX 2017 for them.
So we got 3 and a fraction years before we have any other human transporter other than Soyuz, is what I think you're saying. And that's roughly the same year that, what can I think of it? The name of the great big infrared one. It'll come to me in a second. Oh, yes. James Webb. I think James Webb also goes up roughly in 2018. Is that true, Paul?
We got 2017 for manned space flights from Florida. You've got 2018 for the James Webb Space Telescope. You've got 2015 July for the Juno spacecraft going into orbit, polar orbit around Jupiter. You got this year, 2014, Rosetta is going to orbit a comet, plus it's going to have a lander that's going to go down and land there. Got all kinds of things going. Back.
Good things to look forward to. And we have to make sure we eat enough vegetables, get enough exercise so that we stay healthy, live long enough to see all these things happen. You don't want to miss it because you're in the grave. There's a pun there somewhere. Let's see now. I'm going to go back and see if we've got normal operation yet. Stand by. Like I've only got operation on this frequency. Let's see if I got operation on the other frequency. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. So I've got two different techniques by which I can get through to this repeater. So use either one you want to, John. I bet you, John, you've got at least one more email you can be reading to us, as long as you can get through on one of these 2-3 frequencies. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech net.
KC2WGB, how copy, Dick?
Beautiful copy, John. Please proceed. And by the way, at least one of those emails that Wesley has mailed me, I've got an explanation for the so-called antenna paradox. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Okay, I haven't heard Wesley in there tonight, but he was on originally to radio check. He might be around. Let me check mine, too, see if I got another one listed. Yes, apparently I have still one more here to go. Okay, I have a young amateur who is looking to pick up some of the sounds from the sun, and he's interested in the frequency spectrum, I believe, which is like 1240, something like that. Maybe you would know about the hydrogen noise and what he might be capable of hearing. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Okay, I got a choice of music. megacycles is the so-called hydrogen alpha line. In other words, every molecule, when it's floating around in space, if it's at any temperature above absolute zero, it radiates a very characteristic wavelength. Every molecule does that. In fact, your mass spectrometers, your various kinds of spectrometers that are used in a forensic laboratory, like a CSI type laboratory, they can put a substance into a machine, heat it to a glowing temperature, and then by the characteristic wavelength that come out, they know exactly how much hydrogen, oxygen, and all the elements that are there, how much lead, cadmium, and whatever. You know exactly what's there with that process. Okay, that's the extreme process by which they make the item in question glow at a very high temperature so they get a nice strong signature out of it. You don't have to do that with radio astronomy. In the case of a radio telescope, when you're looking at a cloud out there in space, there's no way you can go out there and heat the material. However, quite often you're looking at a cloud of material, let me drop. Quite often you're looking at a cloud of material that is many miles in diameter, and as such, it really is a very large mass of the material. And there may be some free-floating hydrogen molecules, there may be some free-floating oxygen molecules and whatever. They all have a characteristic frequency at which they emit. In the case of that spectrometer you use in a CSI laboratory, there you've got a microscopic amount of the material, and you want a very strong signature, and you heat it to a glowing temperature. In the case of radio astronomy, you've got miles and miles of cubic miles of the stuff, all at some known temperature, and you can, with radio astronomy, looking at specific frequencies, know exactly what's there. Okay. The sun has obviously a lot of hydrogen. So looking at the hydrogen line out of the sun, from a radio telescope point of view, that's an extremely potent signal, very strong. It doesn't require very much, it doesn't require very much sensitivity. It doesn't require a very big dish. A simple feed horn with a moderately sensitive 1420 megahertz receiver will hear the hydrogen line coming out of the sun. Let me drop it. And depending on what the sun is doing, how many sunspots are there today, how many eruptions it's making or whatever, the specific magnitude of the 1420 megacycle radiation from the sun will go up and down. You can make a strip chart recording each minute, hour, day, whatever, and you'll see the characteristic curve of the rises and falls. Now, that's if you're looking at the heavily integrated signal that you feed into a strip chart recorder. You could, if you want to, take the 1420 megacycle noise, put it into a more conventional receiver where you've got, let me pick a couple of kilohertz of bandwidth, and you do envelope detection, amplitude modulation. You use a real AM receiver, and you listen to the sound with your phones, and you will hear characteristic sound that goes through bursts and things like that when the sun does its various phenomena. So you could listen to the acoustic noise coming out of the sun, but it's going to be a kind of a broadband rushing noise. To some degree, it's not interesting, is my belief. However, the guys who have been doing this, let me drop them. The guys who have been doing this for years with homebrew equipment, listening to the sun noise, moon noise, and whatever at various radio astronomy frequencies with backyard antennas and backyard radio telescopes, or the group that meets at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, the astronomical, why can't I think of the name of the organization? I got to go to my website here, stand by. SARA, my mind's going blank, SARA, S-A-R-A, Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers. and all of a sudden I'm having trouble thinking the name of the guy who is the founder. He is a guy from Long Island who now lives in Florida, or now lives in the Carolinas, I think. Jeff Lichtman. Jeffrey Lichtman is the founder. But if you Google the word SARA, Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers, and you begin a conversation with those people, look at their website where they sell hardware to do this, sell plans to build homebrew. In other words, you can buy from them feed horns, low noise amplifiers, receivers, transverters. You can buy the hardware to do it. You can buy the plans to build it yourself. The choice is yours. But of the amateur radio astronomers in the United States, and this is a worldwide organization, but they're well established in the United States, and Jeff Lichtman was the founder roughly 20, 25 years ago. He was living on Long Island, working for the Parker Hannifin Company when he did that founding. And Jeff and I have spent some time together, and I did some of the SARA meetings at National Radio Astronomy Observatory. They're held in roughly June or July. Very fun place to visit, the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Greenbank, West Virginia. Real fun place to visit. And during their conferences that are held every year, a good group of guys to meet, and they will give you the most amount of help as to how people have done it, what methods were successful, how much does it cost, how big is it, and so on. So I think you want to connect with SARA in order to carry through with that project as I see it, John. And maybe you've got some more questions along these lines. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, I actually do. I have, as you know, I'm pretty British. I live in Corporate Canada.
Recognized, to your second call, absolutely. One of the nicest ways to measure an antenna pattern, and you can do this at HF frequencies, VHF, UHF frequencies, or whatever. Aim the antenna to a point in the sky where you know the sun is going to sweep through that point. Connect a sensitive enough receiver, and hopefully the receiver has got the right kind of a impulse eliminator, because you got to worry about the fact that the Murphy's Law dictates that just as the sun sweeps by your antenna, you're getting this beautiful antenna pattern, the next door neighbor is going to start up a very noisy lawnmower, snowblower, noisy car, whatever. Something is going to come by making impulse noise that's going to damage your strip shot recording. So there's a certain kind of impulse noise eliminator, because the spiky noise you get from a noisy lawnmower, for instance, has a very characteristic signature that can be recognized. And you take, for instance, the television audio that's been used in the United Kingdom for years used to be amplitude modulated. So when it comes to impulse noise eliminators, let me drop. The Brits have invented a whole lot of very effective circuits for eliminating impulse noise. And yet the rest of the data stays there. So with your radio telescope, electronics, with the right kind of impulse noise eliminator, with a sensitive enough low noise front end, with your feed horn in front of a dish, or the feed horn itself aimed at a point in the sky, or your Yagi antenna aimed at a point in the sky, and you watch the sun sweep through your antenna pattern, with proper interpretation on that strip shot recorder is your antenna pattern. So that would be a fun project. So do you want to listen to the noise? Do you want to look at the noise plot? Do you want to see your antenna pattern? Do you want to look at, you might even want to later on make tracking motors where the antenna continuously tracks the sun. And now you can see the sun noise go up and down as the sun does its prominences and as individual sunspots do their thing and so on. Let me drop this one other thing you should know about. Okay. The other thing you should know about is that if you buy Beta film, B-A-A-D-A, I think is the name of the company in Germany, that makes a silvery looking film, and you build the right kind of a structure to hold a layer of it in front of the main aperture of your binoculars or telescope. and then you mount those binoculars or telescope on the right kind of a tripod and aim it at the sun. That's called white light observation of the sun. And now you can see those sunspots vividly displayed on the eyepiece of your telescope. That beta film, by the way, is a level 5 attenuator. In other words, 10 to the 5 power, 100,000 to 1. It cuts down the light output from the sun by exactly 100,000 to 1, so you don't burn a hole in your eye. If you look at the eyepiece while it's aimed at the sun, make sure that there's no way in hell that that filter can ever fall off the front end of your telescope or your binoculars while your eye is mounted at that eyepiece. If it happens, most likely you're going to suffer eye damage, serious eye damage, so be very careful along those lines. So looking at the sun optically, looking at the sun radio-wise, fun project. Let's see what Paul's got to say. WS2N, I know you have a further question. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Yeah, I was just going to mention the 1420 hydrogen line. They say SETI listens to that, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. That's one of the favorite frequencies that they would listen for intelligence modulation. They would listen, you know, they listen to millions of frequencies, but that's their favorite one. Carl Sagan came out with that years ago, back in the probably early 90s, maybe even the late 80s, and he said that's what they would be listening to, because if you're on another star system and you're going to transmit a frequency, what frequency would you transmit that you would hope that other people would hear? Well, knowing that the 1420 is the hydrogen frequency, other intelligent people would be probably listening to that frequency, because they're looking for stars. They're doing radio astronomy, and they're listening. They were trying to make a map of the stars using radio, and you would have a good chance of getting in on that frequency. So that's why SETI listens to that. That's one of their favorites. Back to you there, Nick.
Very fine, Paul. When it comes to what material you're going to use to form life, in other words, we've all known that hydrocarbon life is very dominant on this planet. And the science fiction writers have talked about the possibility of silicon-based life as opposed to carbon-based life. And there's probably a couple of other elements you could use in the periodic table, and you could make a case that you could make a life out of those materials. Yes, it's possible. No, it's not very likely, in my opinion. When you study that carbon atom, you'll discover that the carbon atom has got some extremely unique properties as far as how strong a molecule it can make with its various methods of bonding, and how many thousand ways it can do hydrocarbon bonding. Therefore, if Mother Nature is going to, by some natural process, form life on some other planet, all the evidence we've got to date, in my opinion, is that carbon-based life is probably 99 times out of 100 more likely than any of the others, okay? If you accept that, if you accept that hydrocarbon life is most likely, hydrocarbon by definition has got hydrogen, oxygen, carbon, and a few other elements combined in various ways to make living organisms. So therefore, detecting hydrogen in a star, in a planet, or whatever, is, in the old days, believed to be one of the best ways of doing a search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Let me drop. And back in the days when we were first starting to experiment with parabolic dish antennas, great big feed horns, and so on, in those days, 1420 megahertz, an L-band frequency, was considered a very high frequency, and we thought we were on the edge of the arc of radio science to do that. Okay? Turn the clock 30 years ahead where we are today, and you suddenly realize that the so-called watering hole, in other words, the amount of noise in the universe versus frequency, the noise comes down pretty fast at around 1420, stays down low until you come back up to water vapor around 20 gigahertz. So somewhere between 1 gigahertz and 20 gigahertz is the so-called watering hole. In other words, where the background noise of the universe is fairly low and you would be able to hear individual molecules. However, with modern day equipment, where nowadays with good gallium arsenide field effect transistors among other techniques, you can get super low noise figures at frequencies that were thoroughly unheard of 30 years ago. Let me drop. Therefore, forming a real good radio telescope at, let me pick a number, 18 gigahertz as opposed to 1.4 gigahertz allows you to have 15 to 1 higher gain out of the same size dish, a lot more directivity, very good low noise figure with modern day electronics. When it comes to radio astronomy, desirable frequencies for looking for extraterrestrial life, I think 1420 megacycles is no longer a favored frequency. It's not an ignored frequency, but is it likely to be a method by which they would want to communicate with the outside universe? We think it's not so likely. I'm beginning to believe that a lot of SETI people are looking to much higher frequencies, and you don't have to stop at 18 gigs. You can look at the 60 gigs, 120 gigs, and so on. There's definite advantages to going to some of those higher frequencies. And when it comes to optical frequencies, many of the real state-of-the-art satellite experiments going on these days, and Paul has brought some of those to our attention, are starting to use laser light-emitting diodes or laser frequencies, optical frequencies, infrared, near-infrared, far-infrared, optical, ultraviolet, and so on. Some of the higher frequencies give you a lot higher data rate capability, obviously by the fact that we're using them on our fiber optics. You get a hell of a lot more gain out of a small size antenna, and under certain conditions, it looks like you get a lot greater range. So what's the absolute best wavelength to do a SETI search? That ain't clear. Should it be optical? Should it be infrared? Should it be the gigahertz or the terahertz frequencies, the gigahertz frequencies, the thousands of megahertz frequencies, the hundreds of megahertz frequencies? Each of those frequency ranges has certain advantages as far as penetration of clouds, penetration of fog, atmospheric penetration, background noise of stars, and so on. Each frequency region has its own advantages and disadvantages. So choosing the best possible frequency to do a SETI search today, in my opinion, it's gotten more difficult. You got too many choices. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. I would imagine methane would probably be a better frequency, whatever it is, to monitor, because that goes along with our type of life. So maybe that's another frequency they cover heavily. I don't know. But one of the things I just thought of, if I monitor the transit of the sun with this antenna while the antenna is still, I should be able to measure pretty accurately the beam width of the antenna. Would that work?
Oh, absolutely, Paul. Sun tracking is an extremely good way of measuring the exact antenna pattern. You've got to do a little bit of interpreting, though. In other words, the sun as a noise generator, to a radio astronomer, it's a potent signal, because they're used to looking to a star that's a zillion light years away, and as you sweep the radio telescope antenna across the star, on a good star, they get 1 degree Kelvin increase in the noise temperature of the antenna as that antenna sweeps across that star. To a serious radio astronomer, 1 degree Kelvin change is pretty significant. And with a real good, very sensitive radiometer receiver, that's a receiver looking for very small changes, 1 degree Kelvin is a pretty good signal to them. To your typical amateur radio operator, looking at his signal strength meter, the S meter on his receiver, if you made a 1,000 degree Kelvin change in the noise coming in the antenna, in many cases that's not very much motion. It might be the motion that's the equivalent of the thickness of the needle on your signal strength meter on your receiver. So to a radioist, to a radio amateur, the sun is not a very loud source. Therefore, there's a continuous noise in the background caused by the electronics of your receiver, and the sun noise is putting extra noise on top of that. The bottom line of this is that the chart that you see directly out of the Smith chart, out of the strip chart recorder, is your antenna pattern when mixed together with the measurable amount of continuous noise coming out of your receiver. What you see on the strip chart recorder is signal to noise ratio. What you care about is signal to noise to noise ratio. You got to do some extra mathematics operation on the strip chart recording. The information you want is there. It's just not direct, because it's a little bit like looking through a foggy piece of glass and you're taking a photograph of somebody, and you want to make a measurement as to how bright is their skin, so to speak. Well, by some electronic means, you've got to subtract out the effect of the foggy piece of glass that you've made the photograph through. That's sort of what's going on with a radio telescope measurement of an antenna pattern. The data is there, but you've got to do some further processing before you get the real information you're looking for. I wonder if that makes a little bit of sense, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW for TechNet.
Vic, go back down.
Roger, Dodger.
1060.
I'm back down, and okay, I've got to aim the antenna in the other direction. Okay, yeah. John first, and then Wesley in that order, and I'll be bringing the antenna around. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Dick. Hope you can hear me. All right. Now, if I have the antenna set up and the sun is out of my field of view, the antenna's field of view, that would give me my basic noise line, I'm assuming. And if atmospheric conditions and everything stays steady, that should be what I could subtract from the sun's total when I'm observing it. Something like that.
The answer is yes, John. And by the way, okay, I think I've got it in the right place. And let me think, I've got to turn off this source of noise. Hello, 1-2. Okay. I've got to turn off that source of noise. Your strip chart recorder, which usually is measuring your automatic gain control voltage out of your receiver. That's the way most of us do it. And the gain control voltage, the AGC control voltage out of a receiver, is quasi-logarithmic. And when it comes to subtracting some amount of power in the background, you don't want to subtract logs. Subtracting a log is doing a mathematical division process, so you got to be careful with that one. You've got to take the data, anti-log it. You've already made a measurement how much background noise your receiver is making. You subtract that amount of power from the anti-log number, then re-log it in order to plot the antenna pattern in decibels. So it's a slightly indirect process. So you're doing a subtraction, but you have to subtract power exactly, not in the logarithmic manner, which your automatic gain control receiver function will plot for you. I'm hearing some noise in the background, but I'm pretty sure you were overrided, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, because adding them is multiplication, division, and by subtraction. Okay. So let's go over to Wesley and see if he has a question on that device you were talking about.
Boy, no, I never answered one of your questions. Glenn, Dick?
Yeah, I flipped the wrong switch. Go ahead with your question, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
I had made a note here. I never answered one of your questions where mission control is for Gaia. It's Darmstadt, Germany, middle of Germany. Darmstadt, that's where their mission control is. Now, a lot of European Space Agency activities come from that place. That's their main mission control. Back to you.
Wait, is that the old double violent?
that question, Paul? I mean, John, you had a further question, John, for Paul. John, repeat that question.
Wondering if French Guiana is the old Devil's Island that France had occupied.
Somehow I doubt that, but let's see what Paul's got to say. WS2N, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, there was a prison there in French Guiana, but I don't know if that was Devil's Island. Devil's Island was an island, you know. French Guiana is, you know, it's on the main continent of South America. The northern part of it, very near the equator. That's why they get that 1,000-mile boost over there, for a couple hundred miles an hour faster than we get in Florida. But it's a very good location. But I was telling Dick Darmstadt, Germany is mission control for the space mission. And Perth, Australia, I said Canberra. I'm in Perth. That's where they have one of their big antennas. Dick?
You might be right, Paul. That Devil's Island may have been in the Pacific in the French Polynesia. Okay, back to you, Dick.
I'm not sure of the exact location, but I think DL6WU, Mr. Gunter Hawk, either worked in Darmstadt. Yeah, I know he worked in Darmstadt, and I think he lives very close to that area. He worked for the Research Institute of the German Federal Post Office in Darmstadt. And that's where his great big anechoic chamber was located, where he was doing all of his Yagi measurements in the early days. I don't know if he's still doing that. I think he's retired now. But obviously that's also the location of one of the major radio telescopes. In fact, I can't think of the guy's name right now, but there was a man using a major radio telescope in Darmstadt, Germany, during the Apollo mission. And that was how the German amateurs, so to speak, although these were professional people, were using that radio telescope to listen to the S-band signals from the astronauts during the Apollo mission on the moon. And so, I can't think of that guy's name now. I've got to go back to some of the reports that I've written way back in those days. There's a newspaper report about the radio astronomy work that I was doing during the Apollo mission. And that man's name is there. So, Wesley had a question. And by the way, Wesley, if you want to, one of the YouTube videos you mailed us was on the subject of a so-called antenna anomaly, antenna paradox. And it turns out that what that particular guy in that YouTube video thinks is a paradox among the antenna engineers is something that has been known about for some time. And because they think they know it so well, they don't think it's a paradox, and I can explain that one. N2XJN, K2LAW, go ahead, Wes. Yeah, I'm listening to you on the input, Wes, so I'm going to be able to hear you. Go right ahead.
To find out if this one was the operator, and he could not hide himself, but at the same time, he wanted to send his papers when he returned to the decent father for the dipole antenna. He is actually relating to the E-axis of the ground effect, and this is perfect. The is actually to have the human amount of the first simple fruition that the person sees to the mechanism here. So, you are trying to relate to the antenna part of it. Now you see we have the two antennas. Actually, we have one antenna in one beach, and one antenna in one transmitter. And we have a question. We can't be not operating with the ear field any longer. We are operating with the far field. And then we have a special message signal of the antenna of the receiver. And we have a certain amount of CDs or microvolts, whatever measure you take. Now you have another transmitter. The same exact result, and the second transmitter is in phase, is a current phase. It's not in a outer phase. And the question is like, how much power of receiver would expect to be here? You would expect that it would be 2 watts, which would be twice because of the two receivers that they are in co-phase. So, each of 8 watts exactly the same. So, the question would be, is it just the over a unit of funding, because you're not really the receiving twice, which is the receiving 4 times. And how can the doubling of the transmitter power quadruple the output power? I'll do it here. I have more to it.
Okay, I'm hearing Wes very well on the input. So I'm going to repeat what I think Wes was asking. The antenna paradox that has been stated many times is that I've got one transmitter, one transmitting antenna, one receiving antenna, and I measure a certain amount of power. I take a second antenna, a second transmitter, which is in phase with the first transmitter, turn it on. Common sense, many people would think, because you've now turned on a second transmitter, you're going to get twice as much power on the receiving antenna. You actually do the experiment, and you get 4 times as much power. And the paradox question being asked is, where's all that extra power coming from? And there's 2 or 3 different ways of answering this. Let me drop some. Mankind thinks in power. We build a 100-watt transmitter. We expect a certain number of watts of signal, so to speak, micro-watts of signal, to arrive at the receiving antenna. And occasionally we convert that into dBm of power, and sometimes we convert that into microvolts. Mankind thinks in watts. Mother Nature does not. Mother Nature almost always thinks in volts. Whenever you and I set up a real transmitting antenna, and we've got line of sight between the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna, and we want to believe the signal simply flows from the transmitting antenna to the receiving antenna. Well, that's sort of true. In the real world, that radio signal is going to go to every other cubic centimeter of this universe. A hell of a lot of those cubic centimeters are in the environment of your experiment. Some of that signal is going direct. Some of it's reflecting off the ground directly in front of you. Some of it's reflecting off the ground closer to the receiving antenna. Some of it's reflecting off the ground closer to the transmitting antenna. Some of it's reflecting off the tree, off the water tower, off the building, off the bridge. All of those zillions of signals are all happening simultaneously. Because your antenna pattern is so broad, you can't stop that from happening. All those objects in the environment are being illuminated simultaneously. Let me drop. What does that receiving antenna do? What does that receiver do? It takes the vector voltage of every one of those thousands of signal paths, adds up all of those individual voltages, and simultaneously considering their phase angle. So it's adding those voltage vectors. Mother Nature adds voltages. She does not add power. With your wattmeter, with your thermal detector on your 50 ohm resistor, you and I measure wattage. Mother Nature doesn't think that way. She thinks in volts. You turn out a second transmitter of equal power and equal distance into an equal antenna, and it's equal in phase. You add those two voltages. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that the total amount of power you transmitted did double, but you did it with two separate antennas. You did it with two separate antennas connected to two separate transmitters. You could have done it with one antenna, or one transmitter, at twice the power, going into a power divider, feeding an equal phase signal into the two antennas. Schematically, not much has changed. Receiver-wise, signal strength would be the same if you did that. But take a look at what you've now done in that second case. One transmitter of twice the power, going into a power divider, going into two equal length cables to the two separate antennas. Those two separate antennas are now very clearly a phased array. If the spacing between the two antennas is great enough, let me drop. If the spacing between the two antennas is great enough, each of those two antennas make up an interferometer. It's a phased array antenna with twice the gain. So when you turned on that second transmitter into that second antenna, the simple antenna became a phased array antenna with 3 decibels more antenna gain. That interferometer antenna gain, it did have, because of the phase relationship, a peak in its performance toward the receiving antenna. It's got a bunch of nulls in space in other directions. You're not violating conservation of energy. You're changing where in space you're launching that signal. Because the interferometer has got a couple of fingers in space, depending on the number of wavelengths between the two antennas. You're lighting up a bunch of fingers in space with a bunch of nulls between those fingers. So when you turned on the second transmitter, the total amount of power you put into space doubled. The total amount of antenna gain doubled. The product of the two in the desired direction is quadruple. You will go up 6.02 dB of gain. So you've increased the total power transmitted, you increase the antenna gain, you add the two together, you get a 4-to-1 improvement. The antenna people have known about this one, Wes, for many decades. To them, this is not a paradox.
I may not be able to hear you at first, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW. beautiful. I'm going to tilt the mast really hard here. Well, the subject is using the point of the airplane to get the stability from there. The listener listening to me, he postulated that the problem lies in actually it was like to identify that it's horrible that the energy transmitted to the one direction is depending upon the energy transmitted to the other. That the light is not linear and light is not self-contained, that is not? Okay, now. I don't really I have a hard time to agree with you. When you take the power of space, it's square times R, when you take the power voltage times the current, it's the power. So you can try to operate with the geometrical pattern of the two space, the main two space. It is too popular too because the real source of the dipoles are telling that getting shorter. Yeah, so like, I'm not trying to say that. But then the two antennas affect each other by two does not occur in the free space. One dipole will receive energy from the other antenna and re-emit energy causing distortion. So that would be the parasitic element. But the fact is minimized by the proper transmitter design, so we can forget about it. You were trying to implement the reflections and stuff like that. Electromagnetic fields pass through each other without affecting each other. So we take it as a granted. That would give us ability to see the FFT Fourier transformation to predict the antenna pattern.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Solution requires that whatever was emitted from the transmitter in the direction of the receiver, it is only stuff that would ever affect the receiver. So there will be the power reflection, the multipath, we just skip it. We just take the real part noise. If you think in voltages, you may also think about a force, a distance effect, such as a light, that is comprised of the energy in motion. So if we can analogize it, each ray as the conveyor. So let's say we have from one transmitter to the receiver and from the second transmitter to receiver. And we have a 1 volt battery that is really going into it by the conveyor. Now, when those two come in parallel and you take the equation in parallel, then you're going to have, of course, 1 volt because it's going to be the parallel and the current drawn over the 1 ohm resistance load on it. It's going to be giving you a very much significant 1 watt of power. It's not going to be growing because you have a 1 ampere with 1 watt. That's the analogy that he used in his video.
KQ2 QAQ with a simple edge to this one.
He said that we have a certain uncertainty because we can have those arriving as the series. Then 1 volt plus 1.
Glenn recognized, stand by Glenn.
The double of the power. So that was his concern that he had over there. So it would be B squared divided by R equals 4 times, it was a 4 watts. When we have a...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Doesn't really like...